Thank you, Gareth, and thank you for the invitation, and hello, everyone. And I think just the fact that we've gone around and heard what everyone's doing testifies to the power of reinvention. It's marvellous, isn't it? We've all had former lives. Okay, look, I'll make a few points. Some of them are a bit on the gloomy side, but hopefully some more helpful suggestions as well. To answer Gareth's first question, I do believe that, in fact, the media landscape in which we are operating is very different territory. I often characterise it as the Wild West, and the sheriff hasn't yet shown up and locked up the baddies and, you know, created the new rules. But I think we are certainly at a time when we are waiting for the new rules, and I think they will at some point come. In terms of the landscape, the scariest book I read over the summer is a book called Democracy Hacked. Anyone read that one? By a guy called Martin Moore. He's an associate of David Runciman's. If you listen to David Runciman's excellent Talking Politics podcast, he often pops up on that. And actually, Democracy Hacked picks up on quite a few of the themes that Jane Mayer in Dark Money has run with in recent years. But Moore, it was kind of the best explanation that I had read of, if you like, the way that, if you like, the practitioners of the dark arts, like the Steve Bannons and the Breitbart crowd, had basically been able to create a lot of chaos and perversions by co-opting, if you like, all these people who sit in dark rooms and all the rest of it, the hackers, the trollers, and use them to sabotage particular campaigns. And, of course, the most recent example is the 2016 presidential campaign. Now, the bit that really scared me, though, was what happened when Martin Moore looked at what happened when a billionaire like Robert Mercer in the US, who was in apparently a whole different category from someone, say, like the Koch brothers, when Robert Mercer poured his money into Cambridge Analytica in order to subvert the voting process in the UK referendum on Brexit in 2016. Mercer is out there, and what is interesting in reading about him is he's not just extreme right winger. He's a full-on disruptor. This is a guy, it turns out, doesn't believe in anything. He wants the state to disappear. So in my mind, he is an anarchist. So whatever chaos he wreaks, that's absolutely fine by him. So to come to Karagara's question, this is very different territory. This is not just running an agenda that may be ideologically opposed to perhaps what most people in this room represent. It's something very, very different, which is why I do say, again, we come back to this question, how do you conduct public policy debates with some integrity in the face of this sort of well-funded, and I use the word perversion, using the latest in technology, the application of very, very big licks of money to these algorithms. And the question has to be, of course, we've seen it in the US, we've seen it in the UK, could it happen here? Now, our system has not thrown up a Trump or his or her equivalent, but in the last 20 years, I guess we've seen people that you could call political Arabists, like Hansen and Palmer, mini disruptors. But I guess we can't dismiss the possibility that there is, or at some point there may be, a really smart, really cashed up opportunist who could do a lot of mischief. Now, we know we've got some protections. Our system is different. Compulsory voting, thank heaven for that. And I think long overdue, but certainly nearly all of the states are now getting their act together on pretty serious political donations reforms. And with hopefully a change of government in May, a much more serious and then a nationally coordinated, set of laws. So I think that's all to the good. But I also am mindful of what cashed up third parties can do here. In fact, it was someone else from a senior position from a university who said to me recently, just have a look at the money that's going to the IPA, Gina Reinhart just isn't putting lunch money into that outfit. So let's keep a watch on that one. So if that's the landscape, what to do, how to respond? I'm actually going to argue that it's time the elites fought back. And I'm talking about everyone. I'm talking about the political elite. I'm talking about the academic elite and the business elite. Now, I say this knowing recent history that, in fact, the elites have been part of the problem. And whether it's the elite of the Democratic Party in the United States and their failure to check Trump, the abysmal failure, and it's continuing, of someone like Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, who just for the longest time has failed to sit out of position. I think he's been a disgrace. This is the price we, in fact, have paid for a situation, complete leadership failure, where you now have two of the most important Anglo-democracies in a really serious state of crisis, I would argue. So I say the elites should fight back. I think it's reasonable to say, and we can argue about all the reasons, climate change was a big one. Everyone got, anyone who had something sensible to say on this was mocked, derided, and guess what? They reeled back. Certainly people in universities did that, and I understand. But being gun-shy or absent from the debate, I think, is making things worse. It leaves the field open to the opportunists. And in arguing that they should buy themselves back into debate, I am conscious that in the wake of the Royal Commission, I think if you're a member of the business elite, you need to do that with a bit of honesty and humility, because it was quite interesting to see, was it in the last 10 days or so, the Financial Review held its sort of one of its economic summit, had all the captains of industry in the room, and of course they were not exactly on song with Bill Shorten's message about wage justice. But all power to Bill. He looked around the room and he said to a few people, "Do you think you could live on $18 an hour? Really? Well, just start listening." So it was a bit different. Gareth, I think, when you were a minister in the 80s, you'll recall that, in fact, the great thing that Hawke did in 83, he brought Labor and Capital together. But in those days, you actually had a business elite that could speak from the point of view of the national interest, not just self-interest. And I think of people like Rod Carnegie and those. So it was an impressive moment when there was give and take on both sides. Those days are gone, but I do note that there's a younger generation of millennials coming through, many of them doing their own startups, and who think quite differently. They talk about, you know, ethical values. They talk about, you know, being good social citizens. I think it's up to us to engage with them. And I'd also say for the media to be that much more active in ferreting them out. We should be listening to them. So, if they're going to fight their way back into the public space, how do we do this? How do we do this in the age of clickbait and fight through the static? Well, I think there are some hopeful signs, having been through this sort of dark period. I'm noticing that, for instance, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they've never been healthier and with greater subscriptions. I note that BuzzFeed is on the decline. Here in Oz, I was speaking to the chair of Channel 9 recently, Peter Costello, who prided in telling me that he thought that sales of the print titles had at least stabilised. So for the immediate future, you can still get an op-ed, you know, in the Sydney Morning Herald of the Age. There are other ways to reach an audience. I noticed you're recording this today for podcasts, which is terrific. It has never been easier or cheaper to actually reach a specialist audience. University of Melbourne supports about 30 of them. I don't know what the ANU is. Our just departed Vice Chancellor, Glyn Davis, ran his own podcast called The Policy Shop, where, you know, I think he did about two a month over a couple of years, and on each one of those tackled significant issues of public policy. So I kind of recommend that to you, and the figures on it are just extraordinary. At a time when people are saying they haven't got time to read, or whether people are consuming a lot of specialist information via audio, so podcasts or audio books. Long-form essay writing, I'd also argue, is alive and well via any number of things, the Guardian Quarterly, the Monthly, Griffith Review. And I'd also mention two other things I've seen quite recently that are terrific examples of public-spirited philanthropy. One is Tim Fairfax, having announced recently that he's putting his own money into the creation of a special investigative unit. All power to him. Another Chancellor, I think he's Chancellor of QUT. And we've also seen in Sydney Judith Nielsen putting $100 million into a new institute for independent journalism. And that's yet to evolve. But I just think it's been very, very hard. As someone who's a board member of think tanks, one is Per Capita, the other I came off last year, the John Cain Foundation, the hardest thing on the planet seems to be to get philanthropic money for certainly centre-left think tanks. But I'm thrilled to see philanthropists putting money into this one, which is going to have to be able to be providing avenues for, as I say, serious discussion of public policy. So just a couple of other things I've noted as well, that harder to get it on topics like taxation and all the rest of it, but I noticed here in Victoria one of the thrilling things to see in the last year was the way that the death and dying legislation, or death with dignity legislation, whatever it was called, was conducted almost remarkably without acrimony. And that didn't just happen. A lot of work went into that. But there were town hall consultations all over the place. There were no shock jocks in town that went wild with this kind of thing. And you can argue that's Melbourne because it's not Sydney, but anyway. But a huge amount of work. And part of that work actually was put in by, again, Andrew Denton, putting on, again, his hat as, a public ambassador, put his own money in and did, again, I think 2 years' worth of podcasts, of collecting stories and all the rest of it. It was all part of the, a little bit under the radar education program that was going on, but it had this profound effect to the point where when that legislation was debated, it was done in a very considered manner, and we saw the results. It's now on the books. So again, another good story. These are all good moves. My final point, is that our politicians actually have an obligation to address our degraded civic life and lift the tone. And in some cases, that can mean something as silly, something as basic as standing up to bullies. Now, only last week, Michael Daly, the pretty new head of the opposition, the Labor opposition in New South Wales, soon to face the voters in 2 weeks' time, did something extraordinary. He walked into Alan Jones' studio and he stood him up. He said, "Alan, thank you very much for your service on the Sydney Cricket Ground Trust, but you're sacked. If I get in 2 weeks' time, you won't have a job." Well, now Daly knew exactly what he was doing, and guess what? Last week, someone who's been leader of the Labor Party for 5 minutes is now on 50-50 and has a reasonable chance of winning in 2 weeks' time. But here's the point. Everyone else has run away from Jones for years and years and years. Daly, he knows the golden rule. I've got nothing to lose and everything to gain. He's put his issue right there on the map. Interesting. I just put it out there. One other thing, I think it's not going to happen in the run-up to campaigns, but I think in between campaigns, I think something that I would like to see our politicians consider, and that's the golden rule, really, that less is more. Only say something when you have something to say. Now, if everyone in Canberra agreed to stop doing those stupid shouting matches on Sky TV, trust in our system would start to come up like that. Now, one other thing, not that any rookie politician is likely to follow the example, and I didn't either, but the most respected figure in the Parliament when I was there was Senator John Faulkner. Now, John had a rule from which he never deviated. He mostly said no to television interviews, which drove me nuts when I was a journalist on Late Line, but when he spoke, at conferences or set pieces or in the Senate, people listened because his words counted for something. So I say less is more. In a noisy world, we value that which is rare. So I'll stop there.
Thanks, Maxine. Break.
Thanks, Gary. I'm a historian, so I'll probably do more backward glancing than the other speakers. But one of the most influential some interpretations we have of how nationalism came about, the rise of nationalism, conceives of a nation as an imagined community. Benedict Anderson, scholar writing in the 1980s, initiated this idea. That's a pretty simple concept. It basically says most people who claim to belong to a nation won't meet each other in the course of a lifetime. Okay? We won't actually meet one another. And yet we feel a common sense of fellowship. We all sit there supporting Australian athletes and Olympic Games and all the rest of it. How does it happen? And his explanation for this was what he was a good Marxist, print capitalism, which I think was a fancy way of saying the modern newspaper, the 18th and 19th century newspaper, had brought about that sense of imagined community, that sense of fellowship. Now, if Anderson was right, I wonder what happens when the kinds of reading communities and media audiences that particular interpretation relies on, what happens when they fall apart? And that's, I think, if we want to understand why media disruption is having all of these kinds of implications for the wider debates that go on in the public sphere, perhaps that's the answer. When we no longer have media audiences engaging together in a shared discourse, so much as niche audiences who are kind of seeking out media, whether it's mainstream or social media, where their beliefs and prejudices and biases are essentially repeated back to them. And that's, I think, very different from the kind of model that Anderson was talking about. And of course, what if they're getting most of their news via Twitter and Facebook? What if that's been manipulated in the way that Maxine was talking about at the beginning of her discussion? Perhaps our coherence as a political community, the coherence of our public discourse, depends in ways that we underestimate on old media, or at least on the kinds of fellowship, the kinds of conversation that tended to be hosted by old media. Let me talk a little bit more about that. It's certainly true, I think, that something qualitatively significant has happened to media in this respect in recent years. I mean, we've always had a variety of media. We've always had newspapers that express this or that political point of view through their editorial. In this city, when I was growing up here, we had The Age and the Sun and The Herald, the afternoon newspaper, and then there was kind of the black sheep of the family, Truth. It's Truth. What strikes me about this, there was a sense in which, there was a coherent conversation going on across that sort of media. I mean, that's print media. One could extend it to various forms of electronic media as well. There was a sense that they were hosting a coherent conversation, that people weren't talking past one another, but to one another. So, if you primarily depended on The Sun, what's now The Herald Sun, and someone else primarily went to The Age, you were still, I think, within the same broad intellectual universe. And I think that's quite different to where we are now. If I open a Nine Fairfax newspaper, or I turn on The Drum, or I go to The Guardian online or something like that, I can be reasonably sure that if there's discussion going on there about global warming, climate change, that probably everyone at least accepts the science. And they're going to be discussing solutions. They're going to be discussing policy. If I go to the Australian op-ed page, or if I go to Sky After Dark, that simply isn't the case. I mean, the science won't necessarily be accepted, and balance is kind of defined as, having those who believe in the science and those who don't believe in the science, possibly, on either side of the debate, if you're lucky, and we know, in fact, from research by Robert Mann, that the Australian has been very inclined, essentially biased towards those who doubt the science in the kinds of things that have been published over the years. These aren't differences about policy. They're actually differences about whether an issue is real, whether it really exists. And it seems to me it's very difficult to have a coherent conversation when that's happening within what is effectively mainstream media. We're not talking about the fringes here. We're talking about the national newspaper. Okay, so I think that's a critical difference. And it brings me to the second point. I'm going to make three, like all academics doing this sort of stuff. The stories that Australian advocates have to take that issue, renewable energy and carbon markets, tell, have often failed to gain political traction. Perhaps they're gaining more traction now, but I think you could say historically, over the last 10, 15 years, there have been some real problems in getting that story out there and getting political effects from it. But this isn't the only instance, I think, of failed storytelling. I mean, there's a wider sense that political leaders don't do this as well as they used to. I mean, in Australia, the contrast is so often with the superior storytelling techniques of Paul Keating, in particularly, I think, in the 1980s as Treasurer and to some extent as Prime Minister in the 90s. These, like a lot of things from the 1980s, perhaps seem a little better in retrospect than they seemed at the time. But nonetheless, that's a common contrast. But I think it remains true that you know, almost all of the really successful political leaders of the last 30 years have been superior storytellers. I mean, you can go through them one by one. Think of Mandela. I mean, think of Obama. Think of Tony Blair. I mean, these were people who knew how to craft a narrative. And my observation, and this is, I guess, more for discussion, is that I think a lot of our politicians today are putting remarkably little effort into crafting their stories. Everyone, I mean, Gareth could probably confirm this, I suspect, everyone knew Keating was practicing those lines pretty carefully before he went out there. They might have seemed spontaneous at times, but I don't think anyone seriously believes that that was simply happening off the top of his head. He was a practiced performer. And I think, my sense would be that we lack politicians with a sense of the dramatic that requires, an instinctive sense of what the ordinary voter, possibly only half listening anyway, actually wants to hear. And, one can speculate about why that might be. I think there are issues around elite recruitment into political parties that actually help to explain that. And I'm actually going to come to that point right at the end. Where do those stories, and this is my second point really, where do those stories that politicians tell about values and about policy come from? They don't pop out of thin air. Inevitably, the kind of wider cultural framing provided by ideas and language in the broader public culture will play, I think, a critical role. Politicians don't just repeat what intellectuals or writers or historians say in books, but anyone who discounts the influence of, say, Manning Clark on Paul Keating or Geoffrey Blainey on John Howard wasn't listening very hard. They were deeply influential. This comes to Jackie's point, I think, about the book as we're going around the table. I mean, can we be confident today that we have a public culture where ideas can play this kind of role in culture as in politics? Do we still have a public culture where an important transformative interpretation of our society or our history or our culture, think of something like, Donald Horne's The Lucky Country back in the mid-60s, would that still gain the kind of audience and attention and influence that something that striking and original actually warrants? Are even the best meditations on Australia being swept up in the 24/7 news cycle and the culture wars, sort of here today and gone tomorrow? I mean, some of what we're getting does seem like a kind of reheated, barely Australianised version of what you might see on Fox News in the United States. And I think that's been much more evident in about the last, certainly 5 years, than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago, that kind of American influence on particularly, I think, conservative discourse in this country. I mean, Jill Lepore recently, a historian, made the point in Foreign Affairs, if our historians or our public intellectuals stop telling engaging and true national stories, then the charlatans wearing their baseball caps will arrive to substitute their own stories. And, of course, that isn't just in the United States. Political parties, this is my third point and my final point. We complain about politicians quite a lot. We complain about what happens in Parliament quite a lot. What about political parties in a broader sense? And I think they're a part of the key to some of the problems we're dealing with today and are quite underestimated. We focus on media quite a lot, but not on political parties. And political parties seem to me to have been utterly critical historically in the ways in which debate happens within the public sphere. I mean, obviously they're engaged in all sorts of complex relationships with the media itself, but I think the nature of our political parties and the state of them, because it's often under the public radar. We see the political lead, we see Scott Morrison, we see Bill Shorten, and they become the brand, don't they? They become the face that represents the political party. But, there's a hell of a lot going on behind the scenes, and I think that actually matters for public discourse and the quality of our debate. I believe that neglect's a mistake. What has happened to political parties seems to me to be central to the story of what's happened to our public debate. I don't want to idealise the past. Parties have always included a fair proportion of charlatans and opportunists and crooks, but they do now seem, I think, more remote than ever from the lives of most Australians. Their rank and file membership is small and in many instances grossly unrepresentative of wider bodies of public opinion. We've seen that repeatedly, I think, in various positionings of the Liberal Party in the recent past. They've evolved into what political scientists call electoral professional parties. That is, machines run essentially by elected politicians and paid officials, but without a strong rank and file, a strong membership in the old sense of a mass party. They have much weaker links to the community than in the past. Focus group and polling research are kind of substituted for that, but we've seen the way in which that's led to some dreadful decision making around both policy and leadership. The operation of the parties seems to reflect this lack of connection to any real community. Both parties fiddled while the Australian people made the running on marriage equality. The coalition has shown that it's hopelessly out of touch on energy policy and unable to construct a coherent policy with popular consent, and that's been the case over many years. The Liberal Party's National Peak Organisation voted 2-1 to privatise the ABC. I mean, once you've come up with something that idiotic, I mean, what's it even mean? You've essentially disqualified yourself from participating in any public debate about the future of the ABC. In general, the parties seem at present ill-equipped either to represent large and sometimes rapidly moving bodies of opinion on major issues, or to take up leadership and then to carry large numbers of people with them on contentious issues. They seem rather like relics in the way they operate of the industrial era. And I think the result has been an alarming trust deficit and disengagement. And so my final point really is really to say that I think reform of political parties and ensuring that they're much better able to represent public opinion as well as lead it and to help form it is critical as a solution to some of the issues and problems that we're talking about today. Thank you.
Terrific again, Frank. Thanks so much. Michael.
Thank you, Frank. Well, in contrast to Frank's, my words will be rigorously unacademic. And I guess the subtitle for them will be my experiences or my insights from 30 years in the front line. And, of course, the caveat that I'm also a foot soldier in the 24/7 media cycle, as Gareth experienced this morning. I just want to start with my morning routine. The alarm goes up at golf at 2:45. Every morning I reach my phone, and 9 mornings out of 10, the first thing I see, because every journalist has these notifications, are, depending on the morning, anywhere between 6 and a dozen tweets from Donald Trump. Just imagine that, the first thing you see every day. Decrying witch hunts, no collusion, prosecuting the wall, attacking the Democrats, whatever. Presidential statements, which they are, and what passes as his public policy discourse in 280 characters or less, all in capital letters. And you'll often get, we've all seen them, Democrats, senior Democrats, otherwise sensible sober Democrats, responding in kind. My point is that while we haven't got to this, in my view, emasculation of public policy debate here in Australia, we are, I think, teetering on the precipice, and I'm going to be a bit more gloomy than Maxine about where it's going, where we are and where it's going, working in this environment every day. In my 30 years as a journalist, I've covered politics in New South Wales, Victoria, Canberra, and in America as a US correspondent. I was privileged to be working in the press gallery for the ABC Bureau from 93 to 96, covering politicians adroit in prosecuting policy, the likes of Paul Keating, Kim Beazley, John Howard, Peter Costello, and yes, a certain foreign minister of the time. All adept, this is pre-24/7 news, which I think is a very valid point to make, adept at picking up often unpopular policy prescriptions and going out and selling it, not just in media, but in town halls, in the public space. Equally, I covered Jeff Kennis here in Victoria as a state political reporter, and way back when I was a pub reporter, as Peter Martin mentioned, I was covering Nick Reiner as New South Wales Premier. Prosecuting a very unpopular policy at the time, which was the privatisation of state-owned assets. Again, adept at getting his point across. It was a time of serious and exhaustive policy debate when ideas and policy change had to be sold to the media and to the public. The point also is, back then, up until fairly recently, there were the platforms where politicians could engage in this serious policy debate. Late Night, care of Maxine and Kerry O'Brien, will often have 20 minutes, the entire program, devoted to a one-on-one interview with a politician or a panel debate on one particular issue. Sadly, with Late Line's demise, you don't get that anymore. You'll get that on radio with Fran in the morning. Lee will do fantastic interviews on 7:30, but they're fewer and further between compared to Late Line every night. And again, as Gareth knows, you'll, if you're lucky, you'll get 3 or 4 minutes on breakfast TV to make your point, a different beast. We also had state-based 7:30 reports, state lines, where the premiers and the opposition leaders of the day were held to account and therefore had to step up to the plate and sell their policies. No such platform exists anymore other than Metropolitan Radio. We even had a current affair, a very different beast way back then when it was, you had Mike Willacy, long may he rest in peace, where he'd have serious political interviews. And we've all been brought back to those days. Care of his sad passing in the last couple of weeks, reminded of that birthday cake interview, which I still think is one of the greatest political interviews of all time. Apologies to Maxine. What we didn't have then was the 24/7 news cycle and social media, two latter-day developments that have, in my view, largely dumbed down and fast-tracked in a negative way policy debate in this country. Going back to two issues I covered in my time in the press gallery in Canberra, as to how they'd survive in this age of 24/7 media and Twitter, I have my grave doubts that either would either survive, or if they did, it wouldn't be a very edifying debate. One is the GST. If there was the 24/7 environment, and if there was Twitter back in 97, 98, when Howard and Costello were prosecuting that, I think it would have been a much harder ask for them to get that through. Serious policy platform put forward, as we know, by Paul Keating as well back in the 1980s, unsuccessfully. And also, given how toxic and horrible Twitter in particular is when when it comes to Indigenous affairs, matters of race, I think Gareth, the native title and the Mabo response and the native title bill in response to that would have had a perilous path on the way through Parliament to law, as it was eventually prosecuted. That's not to say it was all serious and no shallowness back then. I still fondly recall writing many, many stories about subjects like Alexander Downer's fishnet stockings and various
other... We had to have a bit of fun.
Michael Lee, the then Communications Minister, was dating briefly Elle Macpherson's sister. That was a subject of great fun and... a couple of the serious GST native title stuff. It was just that all the fun was, you can take this in two ways, much shorter lived because there wasn't this 24/7 social media vortex that can kick it along for days, weeks, if not months. Fast forward 20 odd years and it's a much more challenging place in Australia to run a serious policy debate. Media echo chambers that Frank touched on are well established, and it's a case that everything goes on social media, especially Twitter. Alexander Downer, in fact, wrote on this subject early on Monday, I think, in the Financial Review. He recounted a recent visit to Texas to catch up with Andrew Peacock, who is now living there, about the good old days, as Alexander wrote, when they were about the only people in Canberra to have these things called fax machines. And Alexander was in this piece on social media, said in this opinion piece, we're not being subdivided into warring tribes. We are being subdivided into warring tribes, not united by common humanity. Social media, says Alexander Downer, amplifies this by corralling users into their own intolerant bubbles, determined not to analyse arguments they disagree with, but to hate their so-called opponents. And our politicians, sadly, are doing their bit to inflate this negative debate, making absurdly false claims about your opponent's policies, be it Bill Shorten about Scott Morrison or Scott Morrison about Bill Shorten, often passes for public policy debate in this country, and their proxies, Labor and Liberal, on Sky News After Dark, and on a lesser extent on the ABC, often take it to unbelievable and absurd levels as well. One very serious policy area that has huge consequences for this country's future. Frank also touched on this, and I'm glad to see Simon here as well, because he's an active participant in this energy policy. The established science is that coal-fired power stations are certainly environmentally toxic, but also uneconomic. But you get to Twitter, and those facts are turned on their heads, and it makes it very hard to, in this current context, to run a serious debate on not just the future of coal-fired power stations, but meeting renewable energy targets, Paris, you know, route, all that sort of stuff would not have happened without 24/7 and Twitter sort of subverting that policy debate, that very serious policy debate. And if I hear the phrase "fainting of power" one more time, I think I'll explode. We can cut that bit out of the podcast. Selling policy is much more difficult these days because we do lack the big storytellers of 20, 30 years ago, and I'm glad this has been raised already as well. I think deep in their own hearts, both Bill Shorten and Scott Morrison would agree that they'd never win charisma contests, they'd never win debating contests. But also, sadly, and I cover state and territory politics as well, there is a dearth of talent, broadly speaking, in our state and territory ranks as well, in both premier and opposition level, leader levels as well. People, politicians of both stripes, unable or unwilling, whether it's laziness or lack of intellectual curiosity to get up there and tell a story, to prosecute a case for policy change. We have a generation of politicians, sadly, more attuned to the social media cycle than the art of serious policy advocacy. Senior ministers and their shadows have often resorted to arguing in emojis and GIFs on Twitter, and the less said about those awkward social media videos by people from the Prime Minister down, the better. The daily talking points handed out to MPs before Canberra doorstops and broadcast media interviews aren't new. I'd recall them from 25 years ago. Maxine would be well aware of trying to butt her way through those talking points, but they are sadly becoming much more dense and much more immovable at the moment. And it's not just politicians, it's the elites. It's the head of the lobby groups that have their talking points, and often in the context of a long interview, are unwilling to shift from that to either advance their policy cause or rebut the other side's debates and arguments. It's become much more entrenched, and in my humble opinion, being somebody who has to deal with this every single day of my working life, it is broadly negative to public debate in this country, and I'm happy to go into the back and forth of this round table as well on that.
Well, three fantastic presentations. Thanks, Michael. Not much disagreement from any of our panellists about the fairly comprehensively changed nature technologically of the environment we're in. Some potential for disagreement and argument about just how much cause for acute pessimism versus slightly less pessimism there might be about the implications for that. Two particular themes raised about the critical role played by political leaders personally and by the party apparatuses behind them, and one of the topics I think then for discussion must be, you know, can anything be done other than making a plea for reform or change to actually bring that change about when there are so many other pressures pointing in the other direction? And the other issue about, you know, what can be done is whether there are alternative forms of media out there, the kind that Maxine mentioned. There's a hell of a lot of good long form, highly professional journalism being written. But can we vest any confidence that that will have enough impact to actually make a difference in real-world policy making? So they're the sort of themes you've all heard them. I won't go on riffing about them. Let's go around the table. I mean.